Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Culture the coach has built here is unlike any other in the country. And every day you're learning something. We never stop learning. We never stop working. We do things here that no one else in the country is doing with our guys and with each other. And, you know, it's a daily battle to get better. And we're trying to grow more than anyone in the country. And you know, that comes from the top.
Welcome back to another episode, Not Even D2. I'm your host, Cage Allison, here with my boy and co-host, Neruda. I mean, you guys 3-0, having a good season, 4-0, I meant, and you guys having a really good season. Just talk to me about, you know, this past week and who you guys got on the schedule this week.
Sir, it's been a good start to the season for sure. We played Potsdam this past weekend, got them out of there. And, you know, we play Ithaca tonight, and I'm really excited to play Ithaca there. They're well coached. I know a couple guys on the team, and you know, they got a really good win against Rowan earlier this season. But you know, we're not satisfied though. We just want to keep building and just keep improving upon our weaknesses. And you know, there's no sense of entitlement. There's no sense of like, you know, we want to take every game as its own and just keep stacking days. That's basically the main thing. Keep the main thing the main thing. But how you guys doing over there? What's up?
Bro, I mean, like, it's tough right now. To start the year, Casey Kern, our leader, our guy, he's got diagnosed with a broken foot. He'll be missing some extended time. And then, you know, last game we played Mr. Cordio. We felt really good about the game. We were playing good in the first half. And then probably our best player, most dominant player, I think, in the Empire, Franlis. He broke his wrist. We don't know how long he'll be out for. But when you lose probably your top two guys, definitely our top two leaders, it's definitely a tough feeling in the locker room. I mean, we had to leave the gym when Fran got hurt because it was that bad of an injury. His wrist was really bad. And what hurts me most is, one, that's my roommate. So I got a lot of love for him. I know the work that he puts in, but it could have happened to anybody else, and Fran didn't deserve that. But, you know, that's basketball. Sometimes that stuff happens, and now it's on us to how can we hold the fort together so when those guys get back that they're not looking at, you know, an 8 seed in the Empire. We can still be competitive. We got the guys on the roster. We're not going to flinch. We got a big one tonight. We're recording on a Wednesday against Pitt Brad. They run and jump. They score 100 points per game, and, you know, it's going to be a battle. But we got to hold the fort together, and that starts with every guy in the team. We got to buy, everyone's got to take a step with attention to detail and performance on the court. But, I mean, we got a good episode for everyone today. We got Coach Nevada Smith. Nevada, currently the head assistant or offensive coordinator for Marquette basketball. And Marquette is having a great year so far. They are 4-0, maybe 5-0, actually.
Yeah, 5-0.
5-0 on the season. They just got a crazy win yesterday on Tuesday against number 4 ranked Purdue. And we got a lot to talk about with this episode, but I want to hear from you what you thought about Coach Nevada and about this episode.
I mean, Coach Smith, it was a great conversation. I mean, you could tell he has a great basketball mind. You know, he's been around, you know, D3, G League, now high major Division I, and just hearing his insight on, you know, offense and, you know, building culture, or just overall his journey, I think was really interesting. You know, he's one of those guys that just got from the ground up and just grinded at every situation he was at. And now he's, you know, working with Coach Shaka Smart, who's one of the best coaches in college basketball by this point. So definitely a great conversation. I'm excited for the viewers to kind of hear and learn more about him, about both Nevada and also Marquette basketball.
Yeah, I mean, Coach Nevada is just a basketball savant. And why I say that is, like, I mentioned this, but he's always innovative. He's trying to, you know, he studies film so aggressively, trying to figure out different ways to improve his offense or see what's going on in the game to, you know, keep his guys developing. And you can see that, like, in Marquette basketball. And before we talk about Marquette basketball, I mean, like, he coached at Division III schools and in the D League. And some of those stories were heard about, like, him talking with Daryl Morey or him connecting with Mark Dagnall. Like, those are just crazy stories that, you know, you don't hear every day. But Nevada is also just a really calm, cool, collected type of coach. And I like, it's a great balance for Shaka, because if you watch even yesterday, like, I was watching some of the timeouts and, you know, Shaka's going over to the ref, like, really antsy, and Nevada's just calm, cool. Like, keep, when you can look at the sideline and the guy that is training you, or, you know, the guy implementing some offensive schemes in your offense, is just calm and cool. It allows you to be in that type of atmosphere where, you know, you're not going to flinch in big time moments. And they were in a big time moment yesterday against Purdue, and they smacked Purdue by 20. And I mean, Marquette basketball, you can see the development as Shaka and Coach Nevada, like, from when they got there to, you know, now, the constant improvement. And what I really want to focus on is Cam Jones and Stevie Mitchell. I think that this is the best backcourt in the country. I'll go on air and I'll defend that for the rest of the season. I mean, Cam Jones did something really special yesterday. The first triple-double recorded in Marquette basketball history since Dwayne Wade. Stevie Mitchell is a dog. He just plays with intense effort for a whole 40 minutes. They are, like, they balance each other as well in the backcourt. And I think that Marquette can do something really special in the Big East this year.
I mean, Cam Jones is a bucket. I mean, I'm pretty sure his Instagram is like bucket fam Cam. Like, he's tough, bro. And I mean, they played, like, they've had NBA guys there in the locker room the past couple of years. Like, they have Iguodoro. They had Iguodoro, and they had Tyler Kolek last couple of years, right? So now they have Cam, who's probably going to make it to the A, right? And Marquette basketball, I mean, their offense is beautiful, man. They run a tight ship over there, you know what I'm saying? Whether it be, you know, step-up ball screens or slot drives, right? Or I see a lot of their offense, too. Like, they make those hook passes or those passes that will go cross-court and just playing off advantages. Definitely – Cam and Stevie, one of the best backcourts in college basketball right now, for sure. I don't know if it's the best, but definitely definitely one of the best. And like I said, I'm definitely excited to hear a little bit of an insight on their program.
Yeah, and the last point I'll make is, you know, this team is, like, you talk about their offense. They got dynamic offensive schemes. And, I mean, you look through some of their roster, Chase Ross shooting 50% from three, Stevie Mitchell shooting over 60% from three, Cam Jones shooting 48% from three. So they can all sling it. They can all make plays off the bounce. But also, I was talking to some people over the weekend about Marquette, and they were saying, like, yo, that team guards. So it's crazy. Like, they're so good on offense that that's something Nevada specializes in. But also, this year's group is, they got dogs, like, one through however many people, they can all guard it and they get after it. And you could see it even last night against Purdue. But, I mean, we talk about a lot with Nevada regarding his playing career, because he was also a bucket. His playing career into his coaching career, some of those Division III stories that, you know, you don't hear from Division I coaches that, you know, have to grind from the ground up. And then finally, like, the Marquette basketball, the culture, how – the culture reflects the Miami Heat culture, something that he was a part of in the D League. So it was just a really good conversation, interesting topics we talked about. And I hope you guys enjoyed this episode, and let's hear from Coach Nevada. All right, we are here with Coach Nevada Smith. How you doing today, Coach?
It's a great morning, 1-0.
Yes, sir.
Appreciate you coming on, Coach. I know, you know, it's November. It's the start of November, so I know things are starting to ramp up probably about this time. So appreciate you taking time out of your day to do this. We're excited to talk to you.
No problem. I saw Tobe was on. He wore the worst hat of all time. So I figured I just got to look better than him and I'd be in good shape.
Yeah, shout out to my guy Tobe. They took a tough one yesterday, but I know he's got those guys. They're going to be back to where they need to be. But so, Coach, we're talking off air. I'm from Troy, New York, and you lived in Saratoga for quite some time. And I know, like, you can see in the background, you got that Saratoga racetrack right there. So I kind of want to talk about horse racing before we get into basketball, because, like, there was a moment in time where I was big into horse racing. I followed all the jockeys. I started to get familiar with how to read the, like, Saratoga book. And I thought I was, like, a professional better. Not that I was betting, but I thought I could. And I just want to hear from you, like, what your experience living in Saratoga was and how you got introduced into, like, sports racing or horse racing, I should say.
Yeah, my dad's brother is a huge horse racing guy, is, you know, done it for 40 some years. So he introduced me to it when I was in high school. I'd go over to his house for the Derby, just not really knowing anything other than that day. And then as I got a little older and moved to Saratoga, I just started, you know, I'm working in the NBA. I'm off in the summer most of the time. So I'm just walking to the track every day, watching the horses. Then you get kind of into it and you start realizing it's how competitive it is. And I like numbers. So I like reading the sheets and, you know, the Breeders' Cup was this past weekend, which is, you know, the biggest 2 days in horse racing. So that's always fun. And, my wife and I went to the Kentucky Derby 2 years ago. So I'm going to try to get up to the Belmont at Saratoga this coming summer. So I enjoy it. It gives me something to do. I really only have, outside of basketball, my family, two passions, horse racing and the Pittsburgh Pirates. And one lets me down every year. And one gives me something to do. So I enjoy it. I feel like it keeps my mind fresh in the offseason.
I've never been to Saratoga, Coach, but I've heard a lot of good things about it, so I definitely got to check it out. And I always hear about the Derby Day, all my friends go and stuff like that. So I definitely
Awesome. Like, it's, even if you don't know anything about horse racing, my wife and I got married in Saratoga, and we did the day after our wedding for the Whitney Day up there. So we had a bunch of picnic tables and about 50 people, and it's just an incredible day. The food's great. The people watching is great. I mean, you get 30,000 people on a Wednesday in the town of Saratoga. I mean, it's built around horse racing. The restaurants up there are phenomenal. So it's just a fun place to be for those 40 days.
100%. I have a quick question, Coach Smith, before we get into, like, our overall conversation. But and this could be kind of funny, I think. But so I have a pretty unique name myself, Neruda. Mm-hmm. Not many people. I don't know if you've met a Neruda before, but, like, I've never met anyone else with my name, and I've never met anyone else named Nevada. And, you know, looking up your name, like, Nevada Smith, there's actually a movie starring Steve McQueen, mm-hmm. About a cowboy named Nevada Smith. So I'm just kind of curious, like, how you got your name, if you could tell that story, if there's anything unique like that. Sure.
So I was actually named after the book, The Carpetbaggers, which was then turned into the movie, Nevada Smith. My birth name is Nicholas Nevada. I was brought up in a really Catholic household, and the priests at our church wouldn't baptize me as Nevada. They wanted a more biblical name. So it's Nicholas Nevada. Everything on anything I do is N Nevada. But my mom really liked the book. There used to be a soccer sports bar in New York City. Nevada Smith was really big. And the only other person with that name that I even know is there's a horse trainer named Nevada Lufkin. It trains at, like, random tracks in Maryland, and I'll see it every once in a while. But yeah, I've never met a Neruda either.
Hey, first time for everything, I guess. So
no question.
I like it. But let's get into some basketball talk. And I want to start at your college career. You went to Bethany College, mm-hmm. and Bethany, you know, they didn't have the best history when it came to basketball, but in your junior and senior year, you led the team to back-to-back conference championships. You led the nation in your junior year in 3-point field goals made. And I'm more curious about, like, what your experience was there building a relationship with Coach McGinnis. I find it so funny that, you know, you guys both always talk about how you hated playing in the Princeton offense in your freshman and sophomore years. And now you guys are leading teams that, you know, Coach McGinnis and Case Western, they lead the country in points scored, and Marquette's always ranked really high in points scored. So I just wondered if you could talk about, you know, your experience at Bethany College and the success there.
For sure. I mean, one of the main reasons I went there, I really liked the coach I played for. He's still, I talk to him all the time. I talked to him yesterday. He was a big reason, but the other reason is they weren't very good. And, you know, I was hurt in high school. I tore both ACLs back-to-back years, and I wanted to play. I wanted to make sure whoever I went, I could play early. So I was able to start as a freshman. We got a great class. They were 3-22 the year before we got there. So we got there, you know, I was Robin. We had a player that was, in my opinion, the best Division III player of all time. He was incredible. Scored 2,500 points, whatever it was. Went head-to-head with Jeff Gibbs, who was really good himself and put up a 40 ball with four fouls. I mean, it was incredible. I mean, the guy was nuts. And he's a below-scratch golfer at this point, too. So, I mean, he was just a good athlete. So we all came together in the first year. We had a tough schedule and we were trying to figure each other out. We really didn't know how to play. And we only won 5 games. The second year was when we ran Princeton. We all hated it, but it really taught some of the guys that didn't have huge basketball IQs how to play a little bit. I think we won 9 games that year. And then we kind of talked in the offseason, like, all right, we're not losing anymore. We got everybody back. We've all played enough minutes now. Like, it's our program. And we switched to a more high octane, really spread the floor and just be better basketball players than the teams we played. And, you know, we won two league championships, went to the NCAA tournament, won a NCAA tournament game, lost to the eventual national championship champions in Otterbein our senior year. And, you know, kind of changed the trajectory of that program for a while. They went on a nice run for about 10 years where they were winning 20 a year and making the NCAA tournament. So it was great. I mean, we still have Zooms and calls with the guys I played with. You know, Coach McGinnis, one of my best friends, he took me on his boat in Cleveland with my two daughters and my wife this summer. We try to see each other as much as we can. We spent a lot of time together at the Final Four. And, you know, I've known him for almost 30 years. It's kind of nuts. We scrimmaged against each other when I was a senior in high school. Wow. It's been a long time.
Yeah.
Definitely shout out Coach McGinnis. He's a great guy. He's definitely he's helped out the pod a lot. We definitely appreciate him. And, you know, your time at Bethany, like playing Division III, that's a consistent, like, saying that we hear, just how much they love their time. Like, people who play Division III, how much they enjoyed their college experience, because, like, Division III is such an awesome division that's kind of like unlike anything, right? Like, the student athlete connection, really, you have a bunch of guys who really love playing basketball at this level. So definitely consistent, like, thought with, you know, how much you talk about love playing at Bethany. And one thing I wanted to bring up that I hear in a lot of your interviews, you always talk about how you're a really good shooter and how you still believe to this day that any gym you walk into, you're the best shooter in the gym, which I love that confidence too. So I want to hear, what do you think makes, like, a great shooter? Like, what do you look at?
First of all, it's simple repetition is the best way to describe it. Like, you know, I work with a lot of our guys here, and if you look over time at the best shooters that ever play, you know, Reggie Miller was my idol when I was growing up. You go back even further, you got like Chris Mullin, Larry Bird, Ray Allen, all these like elite level guys. Then you get to like Steph now, KD, guys that are just elite of the elite. Like, no one really does it the same. What they do the same is the finish is usually pretty close to the same. And they just rep it out, and they don't have any reps that don't look like the one previous, right? So they can repeat that motion over and over and over and over again. Like, if you watch us play Cam Jones, no one in the world would teach someone how to shoot like that, but he shoots the same way every time. So I think that's a big thing. And then it's the mindset of, you know, you got to have a quick memory, right? Like, you're the best guys in the world are going to miss, you know, half their shots, right? At least. So if you're dwelling on that and not thinking about the next one or preparing for the next one, you're probably not setting yourself up to make it, right? So, yeah. The one thing I struggle with this day and age is is our best shooters in basketball now are not the best free throw shooters. I don't know why. I don't know if they're rushing. I don't know what it is, but like, I'm sounding like an old man. I'll do it one time. Like, the guys that made 45, 50% of their shots shot 90% at the free throw line. Like, we don't see that anymore.
I mean, you shot 94% your senior year from the stripe.
Yeah, it's just they're giving you points. Like, everyone wants to score. Say what you want. Like, everyone wants to win, but it's nice when you look at the box score and you're in double digits. Like, they're giving you 2 points. Go make them. Like, I don't get it. I coached Duncan Robinson in the D-League. He shot 50% from three and, like, 72 from the line. Like, what is going on? And he'll tell you it's an anomaly, but, like, that happened. It's on – I have the sheet. Like, okay, great. Like, so that's one thing. And it really is – a lot of it is a mentality. You can trick yourself into being really good. And just if you work really hard, like, the guys we have here, like, Tyler Kolick was one of them. He was maniacal in the gym. And his first year at Mason, he shot the hell out of it and was, you know, A-10 rookie of the year. He came here his first year. It was just, everybody's hoping it goes in. The guy's been a shooter his whole life. Worked hard, came out the second, was just talking about this yesterday, came out in our first scrimmage his junior year, the year he wins the Big East Player of the Year. Mm-hmm. He took 1-3 in our scrimmage against Loyola Chicago, hit the side of the backboard. And it was like, everything I've done for the past 6 months is like, what's it for? So, you know, getting over that hump of, you're going to have a bad miss. Like, that's okay. Like, make the next one. But yeah, a lot of it's mindset. Guys just don't have that kind of mindset that they used to. But now it's so valuable, right? Like, the shooting is just, it's gone to a different level. The Settlers took 55 the other night. So it's just different. If you can shoot, you can play. And it's just something right now that's, you know, really high commodity.
I just wanted to bring something up real quick about the free throws. Like, the best shooters, I understand where you're coming from, but it also, there is a whole other element of, like, you're by yourself out there. Like, mm-hmm. Everybody's focused on you. So the mentality part, like, it might tie into why some guys aren't that good at free throw shooting, even if they are the best shooters, because there's so much that goes into a free throw, like, in the mind, outside of just, like, form, repetition, stuff like that.
No question. So I missed 5 my senior year. None of them were in the second half, and 2 of them were on techs, and no one was at the line with me. I used to talk at the line. So I'd get the line. I'd talk to the guy next to me. What do you want me to hit? You want me to swish it? You want me to hit the back of the iron? You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of just relaxing, right? And then you make one, you're not going to miss the next one. You're just going to keep making them from there. I always say that if you can make the first one, you're probably pretty good, right? The first one, you never know how your body feels. Like, you guys play, like, your body in games never feels the same game to game. It changes. You know, if you could make your body feel great, you'd go 10 for 10 from 3 every game. Like, those might happen, but, you know, your shot's not going to feel the same the next day. It's just the way we are. And if you can make that first free throw and you can adjust your body and figure out where you need to shoot it, like, you're good to go. But yeah, I completely agree. Like, it's, you're by yourself. You gotta make it. There's, depending on what gym you play in, you know, there's 18,000 people watching you, and there's a lot of pressure.
Definitely a great point, Coach and KJ, like, about that mindset. Definitely great, good part, or good attribute that all shooters have. And moving along with the conversation. So, like I said, you were a D3 guy. And like I said, like, everyone who plays in this division, like, they always look back at their playing days and relish them. And you stayed a D3 guy with your next couple opportunities with coaching. So first, what I'm reading online, you became an assistant coach for St. Lawrence University. And to give a picture for the audience where St. Lawrence is, it's literally as most northern part of New York that you can get to, pretty much right on the border of Canada, below freezing temperatures in the winter. It's a really good school from what I've heard, and they have a really good program as well. But, you know, you were the lead assistant, you were the video coordinator, you were the academic advisor, you were everything for that school. And you worked from that position to then Ithaca, Keystone, and now you're a Power 5 assistant coach, you know, and you're also a former G League head coach. So I'm just wondering, from someone who had to, like, work from the ground up to get where you are today, do you feel like you carry, like, any type of chip on your shoulder?
I mean, I think we all do at some point. I think, you know, where you come from is, you remember, I remember working at St. Lawrence and having to work intramural soccer or NCAA tournament soccer before we had practice, and it was like -6. I couldn't feel my hands. I'm trying to put a flag up on a flagpole. I'm taking these cones down, and I got to get to practice, and I can't literally feel the ball. And it's a reminder of like, you do what you got to do, right? And you know, the time up there, it was the coldest I've ever been, and the closest city was Ottawa. I mean, it was nuts up there. I spent 3 years up there, and I love the people I met. I couldn't wait to get out of there. It was a little too cold for me. It's beautiful in the summer, which I guess you can say about anywhere. I also worked at Allegheny College, which is a Division III school for my old coach for a year. I was there like 16 months, but only one full season. Really got to do a lot there. Shaped me a little bit from offensive basketball. I was able to put in a lot of things that I was doing when I was a JUCO coach at 24 for a year. And then from there, I spent 5 years at Ithaca, which was, you know, amazing. Had a great boss who let me do a lot. We had great kids that worked really hard. We were really good. We had the best season in school history, the best 2-3, combine them all. But we had great players that worked, bought into what we were doing, which wasn't the norm at the time, and did a great job, and was at the Stone for 2 years and got to run the program there and you know, lost to, you know, one of the best teams in the country in the championship game of our league twice, Cabrini and Coach Marcus Kahn. The first year I was there, they lost in a national championship game, and they were up like 15 and with like 10 minutes ago. And we played them 3 times. We lost on a half-court buzzer beater. We lost in overtime, I think. And then the other one at home, we just, you know, lost by like 4 and didn't play great. But they were wars, man. It would have been fun to see if we could have got in, if we could have made a run. But and then, you know, you get an opportunity because of the work you put in. Like it was luck. But I truly believe you create luck. You create luck with how hard you work, and then opportunities kind of arise from that. When I was at Ithaca, I coached softball. My second sport was softball. 3 years of coaching softball. You know, it snows up in Ithaca a ton, and I'm out there with the shovels, like shoveling off the infield so we can get some grounders in one day. It's different. So then there's nothing anyone can ever ask you that you probably haven't done at some point, right? And the D-League likes the same thing. And that is a different league. You get a lot of guys that are ex-players and guys that haven't been down there. And then you get some people that are coming up from where I was coming from that just savored every moment of, you know, we got guys complaining that we're staying in the Quality Inn. I was like, oh, this is great. Right? Like, you know, it's what you're used to, I guess. But, yeah, it's – you know, the chip comes with everything you've done in the past.
No, 100%. All that stuff builds character. And we're going to talk about this, but I think that might be a good reason why, you know, you kind of fit into the Heat organization of, you know, just keep your head down and grind as much as you can, and the results are going to pay off. But you mentioned like that you coached at a bunch of different Division III schools and you had some success, like your second head coaching job at Keystone, you guys were 39-16 in 2 seasons. So you were having really good career coaching at Keystone. I was just wondering kind of how the D-League opportunity came about. And I was reading this article that the interview you had with Daryl Morey, you said like it was the best interview you ever had. So I was just wondering if you could talk about how the opportunity came about, and then also like a little insight into that meeting, who was around and what you guys were covering.
Yeah, it was, you know, September, after my second year at Keystone. So going into year three, you know, we're conditioning, we're getting ready for, you know, practice October 15th, the D3 holiday. And, you know, I get a weird message on my answer machine, and I never checked my office phone because everyone just would call the cell. So I'd check like once a week. And it was a guy from the Rockets asking if I can talk to him. And I didn't know what it was about. You know, we had a player that was bouncing around Germany. So I just figured it was about that. So then I talked to the guy and I realized who he is. He's a guy that used to coach at NYU. So I knew his name. He wasn't there very long, so I didn't really know him. And then I thought McGinnis was like messing around and putting him up to it. And so we're like laughing on our text strand, like, what is this? So talk to them. They're like, hey, we want to set up a, you know, a quick call with, you know, some of our front office people. Would you be interested in, you know, coaching our D-League team? And I didn't know much about the D-League at that point, to be truly honest. I mean, I watched, you know, NBA games, obviously, but I wasn't familiar with the farm system league. And so I'm sure, yeah, let's, you know, set something up. And I couldn't do it in my office because it was like right with everybody. So I was really close with our academic advisor. So I used his office and did an interview, and it was fun. You know, it was like Daryl and some of the front office people, and they called me back later the day, like, hey, can you fly in to do an interview on Friday morning? And we had just started practice. So now it's like October 17th, October 18th. So I switched the schedule up. I would go practice Thursday. I drive to Philly. I fly out Friday morning. Interview was awesome. It was basketball. Like, you know, you interview for, you know, D3 job, you're meeting with 700 people on the campus, right? Like you're just talking hoop. We did a video segment of like, what would you do? Which was fun. You know, took a Wonderlic test, which was crazy. And you're just talking hoop, right? Like it's 8 hours of talking basketball. Chris Finch was in there. He was an assistant at the time. Calvin Sampson was in there. He was an assistant at the time. You know, their front office guys who were great, and thought it went really well. You know, so I leave, and the next, that Saturday, there, everyone in the Rockets were laughing. I told him, I was like, hey, I got to be back. I got to drive our president through the parade in downtown La Plume. And they were like, well, how many people are in La Plume? I was like, I don't know, 1,000. So I would drive him in this little convertible every year in the parade. He would always request that I was his driver. And so they loved, they thought that was great. And then I get a call Sunday night from a Houston number. I'm like, well, who is this? I'm watching the Steeler game. And
yeah, go Pittsburgh.
Yeah, I'm watching the Steeler game. I'm like, I got to answer this. And it was Kevin McHale. And he basically was like, I heard you did really well in your interview. Looking forward to getting you here. And I'm like, well, I haven't been offered anything yet, so I don't know what this is for. And got Daryl called the next day off of the job, and I was on a plane Tuesday morning.
That's a crazy story.
That is a crazy story. And it's crazy how, like, opportunities just open up like that. But like you said, you got to create your own luck sometimes with your work.
Yeah, and then you know what? Multiple people turn the job down. You know, that doesn't happen. I'm probably not sitting in this chair with Coach Smart, and, you know, everything happens, and just kind of you look back and laugh.
So if I'm not mistaken, just looking at the timeline of your career, they basically cleaned the entire staff out after the 2015 season, after the Rockets lost to the Warriors in the conference finals 4-1.
WCF.
And then you got basically introduced to Eric Spoelstra by a Miami Heat beat reporter right after that.
Yeah.
And you started basically working with them like unofficially in 2016 and got the job for the Skyforce in 2017.
Yeah.
Right. And you've talked numerous times in different interviews on just how the Heat culture has changed your philosophy on basketball. And like I said, you started working with the Skyforce in 2017, and you coached a number of great players for the Skyforce, like our guy, shout out Duncan, New Hampshire guy. I'm a New Hampshire guy too. Shout out. So I got to give him a shout out. But you coached him, and he's still getting valuable minutes at the highest stage for the Miami Heat and Coach Eric Spoelstra. So I would love to hear more about the impact that working with the Skyforce had on you as a coach, but also how much impact did working with Spoelstra have on you?
Yeah. So it's crazy how it all goes back to something so small. We had a player at Ithaca who I loved and I was really close to. He never played. You know, one of his best friends was Tom Haberstroh, who was the beat writer for the Heat. And I got to know Tom when I was in RGV. I'd see him at events. And, you know, when everything happened in Houston, he was like, hey, I think you should go down and meet with Spo. I think you guys would really like each other. I said, no problem. It was actually, I flew down on a Friday morning. It was the day before Mayweather Pacquiao.
And, I remember that day too.
His Spo was fired up, right? he's a big Pacquiao guy.
Okay.
And so we met for a couple hours to talk some hoop, and we text back and forth. And that kind of late that summer, I basically became his like offensive consultant. So went through practices, went through games, came up with ideas. I'd fly down to Miami. You know, like probably a couple of days a month, just to talk with him, and you know, we built a good relationship, and he's an awesome guy. You see on his interviews, like Coach Spo, but he's just he's a regular dude who's hilarious and fun to be around. And he taught me a lot. Like, I was coming from Houston, which was get the best players you possibly can get and figure it out. There wasn't, I don't think the word culture was ever said. It was like, okay, you have these guys, figure out how to use them the right way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, getting there, it's a complete opposite view on things. You know, what they were able to do to some undrafted guys and give them careers and develop them. And, you know, and then being in charge of Sioux Falls when that's actually your main job of, all right, develop these young guys and get them where we need them to be. Hopefully they can help us. And the way the NBA's contracts are right now, you need minimum guys to be able to play a little bit to fortify the bench. And had great guys there, man. We had great, great guys. We were never able to keep them long enough to really make a run. The last year I was there, we were loaded. I remember my daughter was born and we played a game against Golden State and they were loaded too. They had like Kendrick Nunn and a bunch of NBA guys, Gary Payton, a ton of dudes who could play. And it was an awesome game back and forth. And we end up winning. And then we lost everyone. We literally lost everyone. So it was nuts. We had D3 guy, Harry Rafferty, was a practice player for us. Another New Hampshire guy.
My guy.
He was like playing minutes for us after that because we just ran out of bodies. And everyone at that point that was in the D-League pool was overseas. And so there was no options even to throw minutes at guys. But just being there just changed like my thought process of what it is to like build a culture, have a culture. It's a different culture than what we have here at Marquette. It's basically you leave everything on the floor. You're playing, you know, you hear Riley's mantra, right? Toughest, hardest working, best conditioned. You know, that's what it was every day. And it was, we pulled our knee pads up, we put our thigh pads on, and we played. And we went through some drills. And then when you heard like, all right, pull them up, you pulled your knee pads up, and we played every day. It wasn't a ton of walkthroughs. It wasn't a ton of 5-on-0. It was, you know, we're getting after it for a set period of time each day.
Yeah, and that's definitely like throughout all levels of basketball. Those are the programs that set themselves apart. When a lot of programs preach like, oh, we want to have a strong culture, we want to do this, we want to do that, but it's actually like, what are you actually doing to, you know, put that culture on the court is what separates these programs. But I want to talk about like you coming back to college basketball. I know that coaching in the D-League, you ultimately knew like this wasn't the career path for you. You wanted to come back to college basketball. And I read that or heard that Coach Dagnall from the Thunder actually connected you with Shaka Smart. And something about the D-League that I think is pretty interesting. We were talking to Coach Arsenal. I don't know if you know the name, but he coaches at Grinnell. And he was talking about how like in the D-League all the time that he would play against another team, he was trying to like pick their brains or they're trying to pick his brain. So I was just wondering if you could talk about like Coach Dagnall and your relationship, but also like building relationships with guys in the NBA throughout your career.
Yeah, it was. So I remember when I first went to my first league meeting when I got the job and no one would talk to me. I was kind of the outcast, like, who is this guy? We had our first game. We played LA and the announcer wouldn't even interview me. He talked, my assistant was Paul McKeskey playing the NBA. Awesome dude. He would just talk to him. And I'm like, all right, I guess this is how it is. And so when new guys came in from different backgrounds, I never wanted them to feel like that. So when David came in, I went right up to him at the league meeting, introduced myself, talked to him a bunch, tried to help him through. We had some epic games, that like 170 to 160. fun games. But I was always close to Marky D, and we played each other so much back then. I mean, it wasn't a full 30-team league, so like we played OKC 10 times a year. So we'd go to dinner the night before, would always try to grab coffee or something when we'd get to each other's cities. And there was a couple guys like that that I got really close with. And, you know, I always, you know, talk to him about it. At some point, I'm going back to college. This isn't, you know, what I ultimately want to do. And then when the opportunity arose and Coach Smart was looking for someone, Mark kind of put us in contact, and that was it.
Yeah, I feel that. And I definitely, like, respect a ton about Coach Dagnall because he's got my – I'm a Thunder fan, so he's got them boys rolling right now. So hoping the best for him as well. But so you mentioned that Coach Shaka was looking for, like, a coach basically, and I read that he was looking for an offensive guy. And, I mean, you're the perfect guy for that. So I was just wondering if you could talk about kind of your relationship with Coach Smart, how that started, and then, you know, how it's developed over the years, because it seems like you're like a great balance to him. You guys got things rolling at Marquette. You're holding offense down while he's leading everybody. But I just wondered if you could talk about, like, the overall relationship with Coach Smart.
Yes, it was we kind of started over COVID, just zooming and talking on the phone. And, you know, when that was dying down, from a standpoint of getting ready to play the next college basketball season, you know, he offered me a position as player development, and it was great. And we had never met, so we had only talked. So he took a huge chance, something I probably wouldn't do. And the first time we met was after I drove everything I had, I owned, down to Texas and showed up at the gym for a practice. And, you know, it's been great ever since. I've loved every second of it. We had a great, you know, in my year at Texas, it was awesome just being at that level for the first time, understanding some things of how it works, coming to Marquette. I think we complement each other great during games and during practices. I think we can have great interactions in the office too of, you know, sometimes I get some wacky ideas and I can share them with him. And as long as I give him a why, he'll at least chew on it. And if he says, no, you're nuts, I laugh. And if he says, all right, let's try it, then we go try it. And, you know, it's been great. We've had great assistance here. We've had tons of continuity. And we've all kind of been here, you know, going on our fourth year, and we've had great players. The players have been amazing. The culture the coach has built here is unlike any other in the country. And every day you're learning something. We never stop learning. We never stop working. We do things here that no one else in the country is doing, with our guys and with each other. And, you know, it's a daily, battle, to get better, and we're trying to grow more than anyone in the country. And you know, that comes from the top.
Definitely comes from the top. And you guys, like I said, you got things rolling at Marquette, and it goes back to, like, how are you putting the culture on the court? And you can see that in all of Marquette's games, and we're definitely going to be watching Marquette throughout this year. But let's take a quick break, talk about, you know, the rest of the year for Marquette and a little bit more about this culture.
And we're back with the Not Even D2 pod with Coach Smith. So you talk about this culture that you guys have at Marquette. And when I look at, like, your social media, like the Marquette basketball social media, it talks about, like, setting the standard, right? And you're going on your fourth year at Marquette, and your first 3 years there, you guys have made the NCAA tournament all 3 years. You guys have made the Sweet 16 once. You guys have had a Big East Player of the Year in Tyler Kolek. You guys have won the Big East tournament in 2022, 2023, if I'm not mistaken. So you guys have truly created a standard of winning for Marquette basketball. And the one thing I'm wondering, like, obviously when Coach Smart changed in, when Coach Smart came in, he changed the program. But also, I feel like when you brought in Cam, Tyler Kolek, and Igodoro, like, those three guys really, I feel like they were so good for you guys. Like, they really changed it around as well. So what impact did Shaka's first class do for the future of Marquette basketball?
The one thing, when we got here, Cam Jones and Stevie Mitchell were already signed by the previous staff. Oso had just finished his freshman year. So the first class was Tyler Kolek was a transfer. Omax Prosper was a transfer. Then we brought in some older guys, Darren Morsell from Maryland, Kirk Queth from Oklahoma. We had a couple guys follow us from Texas that had signed. So it was kind of something that was put together pretty quick. And, you know, I thought we had a good year. We're ended up losing North Carolina, who went to the national championship game in the NCAA tournament. And then that second year, it kind of molded into, you know, what you're seeing now. The leadership change, you know, Tyler and Oso took control of the team. And they were amazing for, you know, the last 2 years. We were 2-seed in the NCAA tournament both years, and I won the Big East tournament, Big East regular season, went to the Sweet 16. And they built it to what it is. And it, you see it every day. Like those, if you watch the first 3 minutes of the second half and just watch Stevie Mitchell, like that's what it is. Like he had about five deflections, a couple steals, just making things happen, playing with energy and passion. And, you know, that's what you're seeing now. And hopefully we can do a great job of leading it forward. And the young guys are doing a great job of taking ownership of that.
I mean, you know, just knowing, like I said, I'm from New Hampshire, so I'm like a New England kid. So I knew about Tyler. Like I had seen him play, like growing, like basically like when I was in high school, he was like a year above me or maybe 2 years above me. So I'd always seen him play, and you'd always heard about like his work ethic, and like how hard he, like what he puts into the game. So like it seemed like working with you and Coach Smart and also Marquette Basketball, like that was kind of the perfect fit that he needed to like really take his game to the next level.
It was funny. You always, you know, our first year here, you always would walk past the practice gym and you wouldn't hear a ball. You know, as soon as Tyler got here, I'm talking about when we first got to Marquette, Tyler and that class got here. We were here like that April, May, June period before everybody got here. The balls weren't really bouncing in the gym. You know, the moment he got here, there was always a ball bouncing. He would come in the morning and work out. He would do our workout. He would shoot after that. He would come back at night, like late night, get his workout in by himself. I mean, the guy was maniacal about it. He still is. You know, you never know if he's going to answer the phone because he's probably at a gym somewhere, right? And when you do, he won't answer, and he'll call you back, and he'll be in a towel because he just got done showering from workout. Like, that's literally the times that I get to talk to him now, or like after he showers on a workout. But they, you know, the work that those guys put in, and then it starts, you see results from it, and the younger guys are like, oh, okay. So then they're doing it, and they're in the gym, and Sean Jones is with them at 11 o'clock at night getting a workout in, and those guys are coming in at 6 a.m. to get their work in. And, you know, it's just the culture that's been created here, and it's one that's hopefully going to go on for a long time.
100%. And when you're, you know, top players, best players are working hard and in the gym consistently, that's going to have an effect on the rest of the team when they see that, like, all right, they're in the gym and they're producing and they're developing. So definitely could see what you're talking about, Coach. And, you know, talking more about, you know, Marquette and your offense, you guys use like a lot of like drag ball screens, high slot, like ball screen actions to kind of get that tag guy out of the corner, zoom screens, or even playing through the five and just going and just playing off of him. So how do you kind of build your identity as a coaching staff, but also build upon like certain concepts that you may learn over the years?
Yeah, I think, you know, we've kind of catered it around to who we have. You know, the last 2 years, we were, you know, number one in the country in high major basketball and pick and rolls. And we still set a bunch, but probably not as many as we have the last couple of years now with, you know, Cam Jones taking the point over, and he's more of a scorer. You know, he can just do different things. So we have some more zoom looks. We have some more actions through the five. But it is our biggest thing is, you know, spacing, making sure that there's enough space to make plays, trying to get some early stuff in transition. Defenses are most vulnerable in the first 5 seconds of the shot clock. So we're trying to get some things early, at least to get them in some type of closeout, chasing us around a little bit. We're really good when we create some closeouts. We do a great job of retaining advantages and creating different ones and new ones. When we play slow and we play one-on-one, we're average at best. So we got to do a great job of using each other's talents, playing to our advantages, playing to our strengths, and creating some things that kind of open up the shots we want to take. So it all comes back to the space and then the finish of the possession of, is it a good shot, bad shot, and can we go get a second opportunity if we do happen to miss?
I feel like you're really like innovative with the offense. And something I wanted to talk about is I heard you mention like rim domination in one of your interviews, and that's your main identity. Like, we need to get to the rim and finish at that. So, but I also noticed that a lot of your teams like rank really high from 3-point area. Like, you guys are one, getting them up, also making those shots. So how do, like, I'm kind of curious how you found this balance of like rim domination, but how your teams are still like ranked really high in the country every year and 3-point attempts and makes.
Well, rim domination is the biggest thing in basketball. If you can dominate the rim, you're gonna be pretty good. Like, example, last night we had 60 points in the paint. It's not like we post up. It's not like we have a dominant one-on-one guy that just beat you. We use our advantages and get to the rim. And usually those two things open each other up. So if we're getting to the rim, there's going to be more help. So we take threes. If they're flying out on us from three, we can get to the rim. And we really don't take many other shots. So we're going to usually be high volume at the rim and high volume from three because we don't do anything else. So it's going to be, you know, 55-45, 58-42, with maybe a little variance from late clock, taking a couple tough ones. So, you know, if we can be right around that, like 60% at the rim, 40% from three, as far as shots we take, we should be pretty good.
I mean, threes and layups, coach, that's kind of the game. That's what the game is evolving into, or kind of has evolved into, rather. And you just reading online, like you started to look at the analytical side of basketball before it really became commonplace at the college and pro levels. So I just wanted to know, like, what inspired you to like look into that side of basketball?
I had an assistant when I was a junior. His name is Brian Murphy. His dad was a Hamilton College legend, one of the best coaches in the history of Division III basketball. He's on the staff in Northeastern even today. And he basically challenged me to lead the country in points per shot. And I'm like, okay, well, what do you want? What do you mean? It means you got to shoot a high volume from three at a high percentage, and you got to get to the free throw line and score points that aren't shot attempts. I said, okay, I can do that. So that's how I kind of valued our offense when I was at Canton Tech, when I was at Keystone. I valued our offense by points per shot, which is an easy analytical thing for someone that doesn't have a lot of resources, right? It's an easy number to find. So we challenged our guys that we want to be 1.1, and the elite guys need to be 1.2 and over of points per shot, which, isn't that hard to do if you're taking the right ones. And it just kind of morphed into, okay, we don't take a ton of pull-ups. You know, the best player takes a couple, but we're literally living from three and at the rim and kind of diving into that. And when I got to the D-League, everyone talked about like the Suns and the 7 seconds or less. Well, they were only taking like 18 threes a game. Mm-hmm. And my first year in the D-League, we took 40 threes a night. And it was like flipped basketball. You had like Jeff Van Gundy going on TV saying it's not basketball, it's ruining the game. I still have the clip on my phone. I just start laughing about it now. And then all of a sudden, 5 years later, it's like every team's doing it. And I kind of wish everyone didn't do it because we lost our kind of advantage. But, there's still different ways to do things and different ways to be successful. And you're going to have different players and you're going to have to adapt. But I do think from a way we want to finish possessions, it is the best way to play. But I'm obviously biased.
Yeah. You talked about how like now everybody's in that kind of realm of we're going to take a lot of threes and, you know, put pressure on the rim. But as a coach that, you know, you and Coach Smart are always talking basketball and how you can kind of keep evolving your game. So I was just wondering, you might not have like a clear answer on this, but what are some of the things you're seeing in basketball today that you're trying to like keep evolving your offense or like, I think this is the direction basketball is going. Let me get on top of this now if you have anything about that.
I think the aggression on the glass has been a big thing. You saw it at the highest level. You see it in the NBA now. I think we got 45% of our misses back last night. And we're not blessed with, like, the greatest rebounding roster. And we're just trying to get them to learn how to do it a little better and learn angles, how to get their hands free, read the ball a little bit, and just be more aggressive. I did an interview a couple of weeks ago with the guys that do some Marquette stuff. Deep threes, I think, are a big deal right now. Just it creates more space. If you can have a guy that can shoot 5 feet off the line, you got to guard him out there. Just more space to play. And elite guys, you'd be amazed at the percentage that they take five feet off the line and on the line. It's really not that much difference. And the amount of offensive rebounds you get on those shots are really high because the misses are really long. So I think that's kind of an inefficiency that not a lot of coaches will buy into because they don't want a bad miss to be like, what are they doing? That's a terrible shot. So coaches will shy away from things that make them look bad. I don't care. It doesn't really bother me. When I was at Canton Tech, we almost played 4-on-5 because I knew we couldn't win. And I was like, all right, I'm just going to put a cherry picker down there and see what they do. And we practiced it. We were ready to roll. My assistant was like, you can't do it. You can't do it. You can't do it. but like, why not? Like, we'll see what they're going to do.
No, I feel that. And coach, I said something that like you're looking for the future, but you were already doing like the deep three philosophy at Keystone. I heard one of your interviews saying like, I like my guys taking that three. So you were ahead of the curve a decade ago. So I definitely like that.
We use the volleyball line as a template. Like if you're open at the volleyball line, take it. Like that's fine. That's our three line. The volleyball line is our three line. Cause you guys know every court you go on has a volleyball line on it.
Yep.
So it's not like you play in courts without them. So you get there, you're open, you feel it, take it.
Yeah. And that's definitely like appealing to, you know, you're recruiting guys and you're like, you got the green light from the volleyball line. Go ahead, take it. I imagine a lot of kids are like, yeah, I want to play in that offense. But moving on. So this past year, you guys were really good. 27-10, 14-6 in the Big East, which is also pretty impressive. You lost in the Sweet 16 to NC State, which they had an amazing run to the Final Four. And you return a ton of scoring, a ton of minutes, probably the most, like, the roster has one of the highest retention rates in all the NCAA. And I feel like if we did a study on that, you'd probably find Marquette at the top. But I was just wondering, like, you guys are really successful. What has been the focus points on how you guys can remain successful? Because you can't really take a year off in the Big East or else, like, things are going to go bad. So I was just wondering kind of what you guys are focused on this year.
Just keep growing, getting our guys to grow and develop. Like you said, we didn't bring in a transfer. We didn't lose anyone outside of the two guys who went to the NBA. So the roster retention is huge. Guys know what we're doing. They believe in the development. They feel like they're getting better. And now it's like when the game starts, that's your time to show it, right? Like we can say, like, we do a great job development. Like now you got to go do it. You got to go do it in a way that, you know, makes your teammates better and gives us a good opportunity to win the game. So I think that's the biggest thing with who we are and what we do and how we do it. You know, we just haven't had roster turnover. So it's been nice. It's our guys just have a genuine love for each other. It's a huge advantage of ours. They like being around each other. They want to be around each other. They really enjoy doing it for the guy next to them. So if they can, you know, keep that up when the times get tough, because it will be tough times. You know, it's a big advantage we have of the love that is for the guy next to you.
I mean, I feel like continuity is something that a lot of teams are looking for nowadays. Like, you know, like the Celtics talk a lot about that. Like they're bringing back all their guys this year that won it, that from basically all their main rotational pieces from last year that won the championship. Right. And even in college too, like you're saying, that's a big part of just creating a culture and keeping the culture is just having the same guys from the year before that know what, you know, winning looks like. So we usually like to end these episodes, coach, with like a bigger than basketball question. And this has been a great conversation. We got some rapid fire in top five after this, but You've obviously been around the game for a little bit, and you know, you were head coach at the G League level, your head coach, Division III level, you know, assistant coach, in high major college basketball. And a lot of coaches say that like the main goal is ultimately to end up as a head coach. And obviously you've been in that position before. So what does the future look like for Coach Smith's career?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, obviously, I'd love to be a head coach, but there's no rush. My family loves it here. I love it here. Marquette's a unique place. It's an amazing school. It's an amazing, we have an amazing administration. The basketball obviously is incredible. I mean, we had 17,000 last night at our games. So just being here and making sure our guys are ready to go, helping them grow. That's all I'm focused on at this point. Whatever happens, happens. But, you know, this is awesome, being able to learn from the coaching staff we have, not only Coach Smart, but you know, our entire coaching staff is high-level basketball minds and guys that, you know, you can really learn a lot from. So being around them, I don't take that for granted at all. I appreciate it every day, and I love what I'm doing.
Yeah, I love that answer. A lot of coaches, especially, like, assistant coaches, they try to look towards the future and – you know, where's my career going to go? But you're like very present right now and just like I'm enjoying where I'm at. So I definitely respect that answer. But we're going to end this episode with a little rapid fire and starting five edition. So let's get ready for rapid fire.
Let's roll.
All right.
All right. So first rapid fire question. I just want you to talk about like living in Milwaukee, because Marquette is in Milwaukee, if I'm not mistaken, right? So just if you have any favorite food spots or just general ideas about the area, like what you think. I just want to hear about that.
Yeah, Milwaukee's great. It's a I'm a big Italian food guy. That's Saratoga has the best Italian food and outside of New York City, man. There's like seven good spots.
That's a
fact. I haven't found a great one here, but a ton of good like meats and cheeses. So there's a place, Moe's Steakhouse downtown, that my wife and I go to, and there's a we go a postseason dinner every year, just us, that place called Harbor House. It's on the water. It's a seafood spot that's really, really good. And I like strip mall Chinese food. It's like my weakness. And there's a place called the Great Wall in Brookfield that I go to a lot. A lot of Sundays, pick up Chinese food for the fam. So Milwaukee's great for that stuff.
I like that answer. Second rapid fire question. I need you to give like three or four of your funniest like coaching staffs, like different like coaches that you worked with over your career, like three to four guys.
Oh man. My first year at St. Lawrence, we had a volunteer assistant named Mark Bicklehop, and him and I used to have battles, man. He'd pack his lunch every day. I'd buy my lunch. We'd all sit together. He'd go to the bathroom, would take a bite of his sandwich and wrap it back up and put it in. He'd put butter on my seats and things. Like he was like 50 years old too. I'm 21, 22. He was great. We had a good battle. The guy I worked with at Ithaca, Jim Mullins, was terrific. He's funny. He used to make me laugh every day. Brad Cooper, who was my assistant at Keystone, was my roommate. We'd have a great relationship off the floor. I was still in shape back then, so we were playing a ton of basketball together and would be driving to these games and playing. And he was still super, super competitive and still big and tough and strong, so he'd be throwing his muscle around. I was found that hilarious. And then, when I was in the D-League my first year, Paul McKeskey, man, that guy was incredibly if you ever have a chance to interview that guy, I mean, he is a wealth of knowledge and he is hilarious. And he taught me the ropes of professional basketball. And it was me, him, and I took our video guy from Ithaca, Jason Young, who's now an assistant AD at FDU. And it was just us three all the time. And we would laugh and laugh. And we had a restaurant that we went to in RGB after every game. And there was a table that had all these lights, and we would call it the mafia table. So we would always reserve the mafia table and would sit back there. Man, it was fun. And our staff here is incredible. We have a great time. And we laugh and enjoy ourselves. And we're just around each other so much that I think you kind of have to find some levity in it.
I like that answer too, Coach. And, last rapid fire question. This is kind of a different one as well. But so you talked about, like I said, in interviews, how you believe, like I love this confidence too, that you're the best shooter anytime you walk into the gym. So I'm wondering if you had to put together like three or four guys that you really that you think they could give you a run for your money. I want to hear those names. And like I want to know guys that you've seen either up front and like personal or guys that you coached.
I'll give you an embarrassing one. I missed a free throw in practice the other day. It was ridiculous. I was so mad at myself. We were sitting there for like 2.5 hours and Coach was like, Coach Smith, come make a free throw. And I back rimmed it. I was so mad at myself. So Dunk is probably the best shooter I've ever coached. Troy Daniels, who played for Coach of ECU,
yep.
Also up there. I mean, we do a drill where you have to miss two in a row, and we'd have to stop him because he'd make like 300 plus in the corner without missing two in a row. And it's like, all right, just stop. He was really good. I coached a kid named Travis Bader, who played at Oakland, that's now on the staff, I think, with the Nets. He could really stroke it. And one of my former players, Matt Blue, is now an assistant at Loyola Maryland, could really shoot it. It could never beat me and still probably can't, but he could really shoot it. So I'll say he's up there. We used to always try to enter like 3-point shooting contests and things for money back in the day when we had no money. We were trying to like pool money together. But those are probably the best guys I've been around. Here, I mean, Cam Jones and Tyler, elite shooters. Stevie Mitchell is an unbelievable drill shooter. I've never seen anything like it. I mean, he does some things. He does some drills that like Dunk can't do. It's kind of nuts. But, you know, you're around this game long enough. You're around some guys who can really fill it up. And, again, they all do it a different way. None of their shots look the same. So, yeah, it's, I like being around guys that just make the net, make the that special sound. So I try to surround myself with those guys as much as I can.
Before we end with Starting Five Edition, I usually don't jump in the rapid fire, but this has kind of been on my mind. So, like, Ruta and I know Coach McGinnis is, like, pretty wild at times. He gets after it. So I was just wondering if you had your favorite Coach McGinnis story. And if you don't, we can definitely cut this out. But I was just wondering if you have your favorite.
No, I'll give you one. So believe it or not, he was kind of our enforcer in college on the court. Like, he had no – he'd do anything. Like, he had illegal screens. So we're playing our freshman year, and we're getting to know each other, right? We're playing the team that ended up winning the league, and they had the kid that was player of the year, this kid, Rich Williamson. And we're on a fast break, and I had the ball, and I'm on, like, the left wing, and I don't know what's going on, right? And I look back, and there's a melee on the ground. A melee, right? I'm like, what is going on? So they tossed Rich Williamson out of the game. And Todd got a tech, but he didn't get tossed. So I'm like laughing. I go shoot free throws. I come back. I'm like, what happened? He goes, yeah, he's running up the court. I just kicked his feet. He went down. I fell on him with an elbow. He got up, got mad, threw some punches, got him kicked out. We win the game. You remember, we only won 5 games that year. We beat the team that won the league because he got the best player thrown at him. That's all it was. I mean, he, like, if someone messed with me in a game, if someone hit me, knocked me down, I knew on the other end that all I had to do was bring that guy off a back screen and he was going to be on the ground. And, you know, it's good when you have guys that have your back like that.
100%. Shout out to Coach McGinnis. That loyalty, you don't see that a lot, but I got mad love for and respect for Coach McGinnis. But we're going to end this episode a little Starting Five Edition. So if you're a coach assembling your lineup, 1 through 5, point guard through center, who are you going to have? And this edition is going to be the best players coach to play in, like, the offense that you were running that year. So it could be, like, from your time at grad assistant at St. Lawrence all the way to Marquette, 1 through 5.
Perfect. I'll keep it D3 edition.
All right, that's valid.
You guys.
I like that.
So I'm going to go with 2 point guards in the backcourt. Sean Rossi, who's the all-time leader in D3 assists.
Dog.
Played for me. Ithaca. I spent more time recruiting that kid than I spent recruiting anyone ever. And it was for good reason. So I'm going to put him out there with a kid named Sean Burton, who's also one of the best players in Ithaca college history. You put those two guys in the backcourt, you got 2 elite passers, 2 elite scorers, both do it a different way. Both can really, really fill it up. At the 3, I'm throwing out a kid that played for me at Keystone named Duncan Lunsford. He's all-time leading scorer in Keystone history. Can really, really play and shoot and get to the basket. He kind of did everything. He was incredible. I'll throw it back at St. Lawrence. We had a kid, Nick Leitner, who I'd started the 4 just because he was the best passing guy over 6 feet I've ever had. At that level, I mean, he just would make plays. You could throw it to him, and if you were really high IQ, you would just pick people apart. You know, Late was incredible. So I throw him out there. I'm trying to think who was the best trigger. So I'll go the Stone, but then I'm going to give you a 6 man. So at the Stone, we had a kid, Malcolm Boone, who was an undersized big who played in Germany for a while. He played the 5 for us. He was a mismatch nightmare. So I'm taking him, and then I'll bring a kid named Phil Barrera, who we had at Ithaca, who was the best offensive rebounder ever coached. He was a 6'1.5" 5 man. He made that NABC All-Star game. And
6'1" 5 man.
He rolls up to practice, and the coach goes, he goes, oh, you played for Jimmy Mullins up at Ithaca. What position are you? You play the 2? And he goes, coach, I'm a 5. He's like, what? He goes out there and has like 7 offensive rebounds. He's like, oh, okay. Guy just went after the ball like anything I've ever seen. But there's my D3 edition top 6 lineup for how we want to play.
That's a good lineup. You got a bunch of D3 legends in that lineup. You got to make some noise. But that's going to do it for another episode, not even D2. Like I said, definitely going to be following Marquette. Hope you guys have a good year. in a stacked conference. So good luck to you, and I appreciate you taking your time to get on the pod.
No problem, fellas. Appreciate you having me on, and good luck, and I appreciate everything you guys do.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Not Even D2.
Make sure you subscribe. Make sure you follow us on Instagram, Twitter. That's the best way to support the channel.
And all episodes released on iHeartRadio, Pandora, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to your podcasts. That's going to do it. And we'll see you next week on Thursday.
Yo, bro, that was a fire episode.
OD.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.